Welcome back, sports fans, to another episode of the Charity Stripe Podcast, brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one sports podcast network in Los Angeles. For those listening at home, on the road, in the air, in the water, do you believe? We have a great show for you guys today. Director and showrunner of the hot new Netflix show Sweet Tooth, Jim Mickle, joins the boys, so buckle up, because here we go. 3, 2, 1, we're back.
And now, this is the moment you've all been waiting for. We are live on the Charity Stripe Podcast with your hosts, Alex, Josh, and Nick.
We're back, baby. It's the Charity Stripe Pitcher Free Throws, because they're free. Episode 343 coming hot at you guys. And episode 342. And I'm joined on this one by Alex Tossman, the Rock Disopolis, and Nikki Snacks Kreider, and director and showrunner of Netflix's top new show, Sweet Tooth, Jim Mickle. We talk some hoops. We obviously talk some Sweet Tooth. And I want you guys to decide. At the end, as you know, with all our guests, we always ask them what their favorite sports memory is. And we've had some amazing, amazing answers. But of all the answers we ever had, I honestly think this may be the top answer. And I want your guys' opinion. I want you to check it out. So stay tuned to the end, of course. But this one was really special, one for the books. So, without further ado, the Charity Stripe presents Jim Mickle. Enjoy. All right, guys, you heard an hour introduction. We have the Jackie Moon of Netflix's top TV show, Sweet Tooth. He's the director, the creator, and the writer, and the adapter. Jim Mickle is joining the boys. Jim, how you doing today?
Hello. I'm doing good.
Good, good. Well, you're doing good now. A week ago, you were not doing so good, or a few days ago. Jim is a diehard Sixers fan. You had a hilarious tweet with one of your dogs wearing a Sixers jersey. You said he's ready for game 7, and then you're like, is there a game 8 type deal? Gut reaction. How are you feeling about the team? How are you feeling about Ben Simmons?
I don't feel good. Yeah, I'm a diehard Sixers fan. I've been waiting for decades, obviously, for them to break through, and thought they were going to do it with Iverson and 01 and it's just depressing. It felt like this was the year everything was coming together, and they just could not get around Atlanta, or could not get around Ben Simmons in Atlanta.
Yeah. Are you team kick Ben Simmons to the curb?
I've been the biggest Ben Simmons advocate. You know, there was a time, like probably a year ago, that I would have been like, get rid of Embiid, keep Simmons, like he's the unicorn. Like I was all in on Simmons. But I don't know. Even before that last game, that whole series was just like, it was just a sign of like how the chemistry doesn't work. And it was a mess.
It seems like the process cannot be trusted.
Yeah. Well, it also felt like for a while, it was like you could hide it, you know, the fact that he couldn't shoot or whatever. But there was definitely something about the whole like floor, like everything went off. You could just see that it was like all the bad things that come from that sort of all bit him in the ass on that one. So yeah,
or like when Simmons during the regular season has his career high when Embiid's not on the floor, like that's not a great sign.
yeah but that was the kind of stuff that made me think, see, he's got it, but yeah,
he's like, you, when guys are playing, their jump shot usually continues to progress. His has continued to regress. It's actually frightening.
That said, the Trae Young thing, I don't know. Not to devolve too much into basketball, or maybe that's evolving too much into basketball, but I don't know that I like the whole style of Trae's play. I mean, the guy's amazing, but this whole, like, I don't know, that you see it more and more, this like draw fouls strategy kind of a thing, I think is like, I don't know that I like the way that the game goes with that. You know, not just because they beat the Sixers, but you saw him do the same thing with the Bucks, like the whole, like, I'm glass, you can't touch me, and if you're within 4 feet, all I have to do is quickly touch you and it's a foul on you. And then, you know, it's like, I don't know.
It's a cheap way of playing ball.
It is definitely a cheap way.
But I think it's something we talk about a lot, though. It's like, it's not, it's just the players manipulating the rules. Like, you got to change the rules if you want things to actually change.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Like the whole, you know, what do you call it?
The swipe through. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they got to figure out a way to like make it basketball again and not this weird like performance art.
The continuation rule still really baffles me, because there's times where I'm like, oh, NBA continuation, that's an and one. And then other times where
I know
my team is the away team and I'm like, oh, I guess it was on the floor. Okay. Whatever the ref wants, whatever you want.
Agree.
Yeah, but Philly basketball, man. Hopefully, I mean, I'm a Celtics fan, as you can see. for your sake, you seem like a nice guy so far. I hope they're back strong next year.
What do you guys think happens? What do you do with Simmons?
You got to trade him at this point. Yeah. We've always say on our show that your primary ball handler needs to be able to at least score at some capacity, not zero capacity. He doesn't have to clearly be the best shooter on the floor. Like, Chris Paul's not a better shooter by any means than Devin Booker, but he can still score the rock at every level. And so if you want to win a championship, you can't have your point guard unless you pair him with a guy like Damian Lillard. You kind of swing some crazy deal, get something else,
yeah,
a little bit more back from McCollum and swap there and have him and Dame go down together, or the other guy next to him is just a complete firecracker, then he's not going to do it.
I think at this point it's pretty clearly like not a good fit with Embiid. Embiid is the better player, even on a torn meniscus. You got to move away from Simmons. And most of that's just because I think his psyche is so rattled right now.
Yeah, like, I think
so. I'm with you. I was a big advocate for him too. And I still am. I still think he's a top 25 player, but you got to wait a little bit, let the trade value go up, and then move.
Yeah.
On. You actually get something of value back.
Well, also the Philadelphia fan base is like, he's going to get eaten alive if they come, you know, because it's also been like 3 or 4 seasons of him, and every summer, you know, like putting out like these highlight reels of him hitting threes and getting a jumper in the off season and sort of setting you up for thinking that's coming, and then it never comes. So it's like, even if he does put in the work, no one's going to believe it too. So it's, like the boy who cried wolf.
It's like the Fast and the Furious 9 trailer. Everyone's like, oh, Cena's in it. It's going to be great. But apparently it's not that good.
Oh, really?
I'm
going to see it tonight. So.
I have to. I heard a spoiler from my roommate went last night, and he was there for 2.5 hours, and he came back and gave me a spoiler, which I will not reveal on the show or to you. But it had me cackling in my room to like the week. Loud laughing, couldn't stop.
Good.
Jim, are you a member of the A-List, AMC A-List premiere?
No, what is that?
It's like there was AMC Movie Pass before.
Oh,
pre-world shutting down. Where you pay like a monthly subscription and you get to see X amount of movies per week for free.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I haven't been to a movie theater in forever.
Are you excited?
The last one. I am. It's I know Dan Casey, the writer, is a friend of mine. So he rented out a theater. So it's kind of a controlled, you know, it's like a friends and family kind of a thing. So that'll be fun. But the last movie I saw in the theater was like in New Zealand. We were so excited during COVID. We were, you know, obviously shooting in New Zealand. We were so excited. We went to see Promising Young Woman at a theater there.
That was great.
Linda, my wife, are the only ones in the theater. So it's like, we didn't even get the theater experience there.
But we see that Robert Downey Jr. got attached to this. And what was it like getting the call from them?
Well, I had been talking to his company, specifically Amanda Burrell, who is part of the team there. I'd been talking to her for kind of a long time. She was somewhere else. She was somewhere else, and I was talking to them about a project. And then years later, she went to Team Downey, and then we were talking about stuff there and really liked the vibe of the kind of stuff that they were trying to do. And we really hit it off. And so it was kind of one of those, like, whenever you come to, I'm from New York. So whenever you come to LA, you kind of would meet with Amanda and talk about stuff. And then they, at some point I got a call saying, you know, from them saying, have you ever heard of this comic book, Sweet Tooth? We're trying to crack a series version of this, and I had read it when it first came out, and it was like on my bookshelf still, and I was like, yeah, absolutely, like, you know, you have to send it to me, I have it, I can reread it.
That's awesome.
So that was super cool. And they're awesome, they're great, they've been so supportive from the get-go, and you know, it's been a long road getting the show to air and to get it made and put together, and they've just been incredibly supportive the whole way.
We always talk to athletes about their first day on the field or when they walk through the tunnel, or, you know, we've had Marshall Faulk on, he talked about, you know, coming through the tunnel for the Super Bowl and how it changes.
Oh, that's cool.
What was it like first day on set for this show for you?
Trying to think of what the first day of set was. We eased into it. So we ended up, it was actually an incredibly surreal experience, because we were shooting in the South Island of New Zealand, which is where they, you know, shot a lot of the beauty stuff in Lord of the Rings. And, you know, we're on top of a mountain, and we were shooting basically the end of the pilot when Gus is like running through those epic landscapes and stuff. So we were up there with a drone, you know, doing aerial stuff. And it was the first day with Will, and Jeff Lemire, the creator of the comic, had just arrived. So it was like, he was pulling up in like a 15 passenger van to the top of this mountain. You know, it takes like 15 minutes even to drive to the top of. And it was pretty epic shooting those like final shots of him. But it was like, we kind of went into it knowing that we wanted to ease into the shoot by like sort of shooting all the amazing stuff, easing Gus into it and the ears and all that. But it was amazing. It's, you know, it's probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
Are you a big Lord of the Rings fan?
I'm not actually. I mean, I like them, but I'm not, you know, somebody that kind of freaks out over it. But I'm a big Peter Jackson fan because I got interested in film through like his early stuff. And yeah, Bad Taste and Dead Alive were like huge ones for me growing up. So if anything, it was even that more so.
Yeah.
Because there were some people that had worked on those movies. So
was it kind of surreal just like shooting there in general after like one of your heroes had done it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I also was a really big fan of the Evil Dead remake from like 2010 or whatever. And that shot there with a lot of the same crew. And just, I just love the way that looked, like the way that they shot it, the look of the woods. Like there was just a whole vibe to it that I was kind of obsessed with the look of that for a long time. And then all of a sudden you're there and it's like, we're getting that cool kind of Grimm's fairy tale kind of a thing.
Yes, it definitely had that feel. Was it tough to leave? Because I'm sitting there, I'm like, damn. Yeah. If I was y'all, I would have stayed.
Well, we did the pilot in 2019 before COVID, and then we came back, wrote the rest of the series, and then had to then stand down for COVID for a couple months. Then we went back in the middle of COVID, so we were there like in the summer last time shooting. And then we wrapped it like Christmas, and then my partner and I, we stayed on for another couple of months, really just thinking like, do we want to go back? You know, are we going to just, are we, you know, it was like the January 6th had just happened, and we were like, you know, and the numbers are spiking. We're like, do we want to go back to this country? You know, we can just stay here. But we missed our dogs ultimately, so we came back.
Yeah, I mean, look at those. Let's just listen to the audio. There's two dogs in the background of Jim, and they are
passed out.
Cute.
One
as hell.
Is snoring. You're probably gonna hear.
No, that. You're good. We pre-record, so we could take that out of the audio if we.
Funny.
So that's really interesting that y'all shot the pilot a year prior to the rest of the series. Yeah, was that because crazy. you were pitching it? I know a lot of projects that go on Netflix are straight to series. So how did that kind of all happen?
Well, we started with Hulu originally. We pitched the show. It was not an easy pitch, you know, I remember somebody asked like, so wait, does the character walk around on all fours? You know, it was like, it was a hard thing for people to understand. But Jordan Hellman, who is at Hulu, and Sasha Silver, I had worked with Jordan on another show at Sundance called Happen Leonard. And he was just like, he believed in the show. And so he was like, we're going to make this at Hulu. So we made the pilot at Hulu. It went really well. And we thought, great. You know, we came back. We're like, this is like the coolest show. And people were already, you know, hearing. I was already getting calls and people hearing like, we heard the show is amazing. And we're like, we're going forward. This is great. And then Disney acquired Hulu kind of like right around that time. And suddenly there was shifts and no one knew who was making decisions and what was going to happen. And we're like, I think we're going to go forward. And then next thing you know, we're like, we're not going forward, and never really got a solid answer about what happened. So at that point, Warner Brothers was like, we're not going to let this project die. Susan Rovner, I give her so much credit. She's like, we're not going to let this project die. And Netflix ended up watching it and picked it up. And you know, we were always hoping that we'd be with Netflix anyway. So it actually worked out for everybody. But it was a weird, long, circuitous road, you know?
And yeah. In the middle
Hulu's
of...
loss.
Yeah, who big time. In the middle of the pilot and shooting the rest of the series, something in the world happens that's very relevant to what happens, without giving a true spoiler. Like, there is a pandemic that occurs in the show. It's called The Sick. So what were the conversations like when you're going back to the project after the world has shut down?
It was weird because the pilot obviously opens with it, and we, you know, we always imagine really the show sort of uses that whole pandemic thing really as a launching point to sort of do the series. So it's, you know, it's a big part, but it's also a small part the same way. But those first couple minutes of the pilot was always like, how, let's watch, you know, the world fall apart basically in a couple minutes, you know, through one character's point of view. And a lot of that, when we were shooting that stuff, like we were shooting in a hospital, again, this is like summer of 2019, we were shooting in a hospital. We had medical experts there to sort of advise, and they were always like, you know, so-and-so is going to be wearing a mask and someone's going to be, you know, and it was all describing all the stuff that was going to happen the next year. And it was like, kind of going like, yeah. But no one really knows that, you know, like we're going to tell the best story, you know? So we were sort of like fudging some of, not really fudging, but it was like, it was always kind of asking them like, we're going to get away with this. You know, like Dr. Singh, for example, is like, you know, he's got a mask on, but he's only in the show for like 3 minutes. So we want to see his face. So we're going to have to find opportunities. So it was all that. So the whole mask thing was actually like already weirdly in my mind, only because we had just kind of dealt with trying to shoot it. So anyway, so that was that. We were doing a lot of research at the time about superbugs. I remember there was a story in the New York Times, I think, about how like antibiotic resistant bugs were going to be something that was going to topple countries or something at some point, you know. And it was this terrifying article that we were sharing on set, you know. The comic book, you know, version of the sick is much more of a like horror kind of a thing. Like it's a little bit more 28 days later kind of a thing. And we had sort of made the decision like, you know, this isn't really the story. Let's just lean into an idea that it's basically like a really like a flu on steroids, basically. So anyway, so that was all that. We shot it. And then we started the writer's room like in January. We were about 6 weeks into it. About 2 months into it, actually. We had written episodes 2 and 3 and we had mapped out the whole series, and we were having like all these like philosophical discussions about like what happens if there's a pandemic and you're alone. What happens? You probably go in your house and you probably don't leave because you don't know if you can go out. So, you know, we wrote that thing in episode 2 where that Amy character basically is like does a little quarantine, you know, stays at home.
Right. It reminded me of one of my friends, dude. Like one of my buddies, we went to his place. Yeah, oh yeah, we went to his place during the pandemic. He was alone for like months, and there's all these plants. Wow. He's like a botanist out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Matt Damon, so
that
Martian.
that stuff was already written. We started getting into stuff about like the politics of like masks and how people start to hang out and all this, you know, all this stuff that you're sort of having these like what seem like speculative conversations, and then all of a sudden, you know, it kind of starts happening. And it was really surreal because, you know, something that you'd spend hours talking about in the writer's room, like the next day would all of a sudden be like the main headline.
Right.
And I, you know, I told this story before. There's one of our writers wrote this scene where a character has a mask and it's like a personalized, like bedazzled mask. And I remember we had this like debate about like, are we just going too far now? The idea that, you know, we'd have personalized masks or something.
Do you think that it made your job easier as writers because of COVID, or do you think it made it harder to kind of accurately depict things?
Weirdly, right in the middle, I got to say, because on the one hand, being able to come here and sit here every day, 5 days a week, and while everyone is sort of confused and doesn't know what's going on in the world, you know, being able to sit and talk about it in a way, but not have to talk about it in terms of our lives all the time, but sort of applying it to a story that we could all focus on, like that gave such a structure to life in a way. You know, I know a lot of people that suffered because it was like, you know, suddenly they don't have the 9 to 5 of work or whatever. But I think all of a sudden, you know, we all had this thing and we could all sort of bond over it. And that's part of the writer's room experience. So that was really good. We also, I think, were smart enough to not try to guess too much about what was going to happen, because it felt like once you're in the eye of the hurricane, it's hard to sort of digest what it looks like or how it's going to affect the world in a couple of years. So we already luckily sort of had our story mapped out, and it was like, we're going to stick to the story that we're telling. And if it echoes the world, great. If not, that's great too.
How much do you guys want to stick to the comics, or how much like leeway were you given to kind of break off from that?
We stretched pretty far. I have to say, the comics, I don't know if you're familiar with the comics, but they're very dark. They're like very, very, they're dark, but there's like a melancholy kind of a thing to them. And Jeff, you know, Jeff as a writer writes kind of bittersweet things. That's one of the reasons I love them. And they're very emotional, but when they hit, they can hit really hard. And early on, we leaned into a sort of a more hopeful tone, a bit more colorful tone, and tried to find a sort of a new way to look sort of at apocalyptic stories, basically. And all those little decisions sort of led to a show that tonally is very different from the comic book, even though it's still, there's some things that are spot on, but there's a lot of things that are like, Jeff goes this way, we go this way to get there. it wasn't a lot of like question of like, should we or leeway or whatever. Like I shared the pilot with Jeff, which was the script, which had things that were completely as they are in the books and things that were completely made up. But I think he appreciated those changes and he's adapted his own stuff and he understands like how that goes. And so I think he respected those changes and had a trust in us that we weren't going to, you know, screw it up.
It's interesting. I haven't read the comic myself, but that you mm-hmm. This is kind of dumbing it down, but you lightened the tone a little bit. And yeah. I think it's really interesting because I know your background, you already mentioned Evil Dead and you've done a lot of yeah. horror. Was that kind of in the opposite direction of like where your initial thoughts were? You're like, let's make this really dark. Let's go yeah. all in.
Well, I did in 2010, like the same time that the reason I know the comic book was because almost the same time that came out, I made a movie called Stakeland, which has a lot of similarities to this movie. It's like, you know, it's apocalyptic, kind of apocalyptic horror. And it's like kind of a lone wolf and cub story with vampires. And it, I think, is pulling from a lot of the same references and types of stories that Jeff is in the comic book. And so that was one of the reasons I knew of the comic book and was a fan of it at the time. And it was kind of like looking at it, you know, when we started talking to Team Downey, it was 2016. And I was kind of like, A, I feel like I've already done this, but also the world has already seen this kind of story. And, you know, we're on like, you know, whatever season 4,000 of Walking Dead, you know, is this really what people are dying to see more of? And so it first started with, you know, how do we find a new way into that? At the time I just had a movie that was supposed to start shooting and it fell apart, you know, a week before shooting. And it was like, it was so soul crushing. And at the time there was a lot of like turmoil in the world. And it was like, I was diving into the story and just thinking like, man, it's kind of dark, you know, there's a lot of darkness right now. And this is kind of dark. And do I want to sign up for something that's going to be like more years of creating dark right. stuff to sort of show the world how dark it all is? And so I started just kind of going, what if we went the other way? And what if we did a story where like you actually wanted to go to this place after the world fell apart? You know, it was beautiful and lush and nature took over. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of started with that thought experiment. And then it really grew from there.
Did it help centering around the kids as well?
And making yeah, definitely.
Like a major focal point of the piece.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the comic book, Gus is very innocent, very naive. And a lot of the comic is him going out into the world and seeing things that sort of just squash his hopes in a way, you know, yeah, but he still stays naive and stays innocent. And we kind of went with like, that's the story, you know, is he grew up in the woods and grew up in my mind in sort of a perfect setting, you know, and didn't have to deal with, you know, people or cynicism or anything, you know, and now he's going out into this apocalyptic world, sort of being like, what kind of a world was there before I came along? Like, this is, you know, that felt like the sort of the more interesting way in, I guess.
Yeah. So a lot of the story, at least for the main character, and again, this is not really giving anything away, is mm-hmm. he's our main character, who's a young boy, is on a journey, and he's mm-hmm. going on this journey with an older mentor who he kind of like just out of happenstance gets conjoined with. Right. And
yeah.
it's very similar to a lot that we've seen. Like, it's like Arya and the Hound in Game of Thrones. Like, what do you think it is about these kind of like weird duos that everyone gravitates towards?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think there's like kind of, you know, I think there's kind of a samurai sort of student teacher, you know, kind of a fable behind all those things, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, whether it's, you know, this or the road or, you know, literally lone wolf and cub or even like Zombieland or something, you know, there's something about, I don't know, there's something about that kind of a story of like one generation teaching the next generation something while they're looking at, you know, the worst instance of what happened to the world. Something about that, I think that it's one of those kinds of stories, like a good Western or a good like samurai story, that you can kind of tell in a lot of different iterations, I guess.
I don't know if this was intentional, but I think it was really well captured talking about the older teaches the younger, but there's a lot mm-hmm. that the younger teaches the older.
Yeah.
In yep. this respect, was that intentional?
Yeah, definitely. And that's there in the comic book. And I think it was there, but it's it's as Jeff said, I think in the comic book, I think it's the darker stuff and it's the sort of more horrific stuff in the foreground, and the heart and the sort of innocence kind of sneaks up on you. And I think we're sort of the opposite in some ways. You know, we pull you in with a bit of hope and a big heart, and then sort of allow the sort of the more the creepiness stuff to come in when you least expect it. So yeah, so that was definitely a big part of it, was like, not only is Gus going to see how dark or sort of how heavy the world is, but he's going to be able to introduce to all these people who've had to deal with it, you know, that stuff like compassion and you know, optimism is like not necessarily dead.
How was the overall vibe on the set from a point of view that it's a lot of people's first major project?
Great. Fantastic. Mostly due to New Zealand and just how they, there's a sort of like the living conditions are amazing, obviously, but the working conditions are fantastic. And it's very much like a family sort of affair, you know. It's a small film community. Everyone has worked together at some point, you know, they've all worked in different capacities. But that definitely trickles to how the workday goes. So the workday is a little shorter there, which is fantastic because, you know, film sets go forever. It's a little bit shorter there, so it's a little bit more humane, so you can actually get like a good night's sleep and you can do the grind without, you know, just being destroyed. But also everybody really took, you know, especially the younger actors under their wing, and really, you know, we would do these like boot camps before, which was like movement training and like parkour training with the kids, even if they didn't have to do some of that on screen, but it was like a camp for them, so they all got to learn from each other.
Yeah,
so they really felt, by the time they got there, they really felt, you know, confident and felt like they were a family already. And then the same thing for the crew. So I just can't say enough great stuff about our whole crew and just how they look at telling stories and collaborating on things together is just really is great.
At the end of the day, people want to work with people that are fun to work with and great work environments. And I think that definitely you create an ecosystem there that is positive and uplifting, and it translates to how they act, and
yep,
the rest goes on.
Yeah, I think you can see it on screen. I think it translates, you know, on screen. You know, I worked on crews for a long time before I got to do this, and it was like, you know, you can tell the ones that were like where no one wanted to be there. Yeah, you can tell.
For sure.
100%. Yeah. I mean, like, even like it translates to any kind of medium. If you do a podcast, we've interviewed a lot of people. We've been very fortunate that everyone, like, for the most part, is down to be here and is down to be a part of the game. But I mean, we've seen another podcast that people are just not down to be a part of. We talk to other people in our industry. We've all been on sets before as well. And I think for the most part, we've all had really great experience on sets. But it can be like one of those things where it's like day three and everyone's are like day three, day six. It's like, we're halfway there and people are just dragging. And I think honestly, it's funny you mention it, because a lot of I know I've shot some stuff in like New York mainly, but like the vibe of New York, Philly and Boston is infinitely different than the vibe of New Zealand. It's like, that you're shooting over there.
Yeah.
Off the feeling question though, what was the feeling then like after seeing the credits roll for you for the first time? It's on Netflix, first episode's done, you see, boom, Jim Mickle. How does that
feel? It was very surreal, because we had, you know, that pilot was in my life for like 3 years or something, you know, whatever. I guess we finished it in 2019. You know, there's a period of time where it was like, man, no one's ever going to see this. You know, it's like, am I going to have to get like request a DVD so that I can just tell people like, hey, we made a cool thing. So you sort of have this relationship with it. We worked on it so much because we did some recuts with Netflix. And so for you fall in and out of love with it. You know, at one point you're totally in love with it. At one point you're like, I never want to see this thing again. I never want to look at this thing again. It just feels like heartbreak and work, and you know, it actually is stressful to look at it. And the show itself, the rest of the show, we were literally working on it up until days before it aired. Like, we were still getting in like final music cues and sound effects and stuff like that. And so you're sort of, everything about it is like, you're so in it. And then the first night that it came out, we sat and we watched all of them back to back, and it was the first time I was able to watch it like as an audience and really appreciate a lot of things that I couldn't even appreciate when we were in the middle of it, but also get swept up in it emotionally. And then to see the whole world sort of all as one sort of, you know, connecting with it. It was just mind blowing. It's so cool. I still can't really wrap my head around it, to be honest.
For those listening, I recommend you do it in one shot. I did episodes. I did episodes 1 through 5, and then I didn't do it in one fell swoop. I did episodes 1 through 5, and I did episodes 6 through 8. I thought this means anything. I thought I was in episode like 3, but it turns out I was on episode 6. I'm like, dang, this thing's moving. I was like,
yeah,
but because there's so much going on with time as well.
Yeah.
Was that difficult for you, just kind of piecing it together?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was, you know, months and months and months of writer's rooms, and especially when it got to this format, because when you're in a physical writer's room with other writers, you know, you're surrounded by whiteboards, and you're drawing maps and, you know, timelines and all kinds of stuff. And all of a sudden you're in this format. Yeah. And, you know, we sort of adopted, you know, you start with like Google Docs and all these different apps to try to track that stuff, but it never quite works. You never really know if everyone's looking at the same thing. So that got very, 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 very complicated. But, you know, thankfully, a lot of smart people are involved to sort of correct you when you start to drift.
Yeah. Was it like, I mean, you're like technically the head, to equate it to sports, you're the head coach. But like, did you look to your, like, I guess the general manager, whoever that would be, or the owners a lot to kind of help guide you?
I mean, we have a lot of people involved. So obviously, like, you know, Team Downey is, there's 4 people there, you know, all of whom are very hands-on and get really in the weeds. My partner Linda, you know, is always the first person that sees anything I do, and she's always catching stuff, you know. And she's, you know, she was there with me helping, you know, the really, like, in the very first episode, those young kids, you know, that are like sort of like can't get them out of their shell, like she's there with them rehearsing, reading children's books with them, getting them to open up and stuff. So already there's a lot. I had a co-showrunner, Beth Schwartz, who had done Arrow for 8 seasons, and so there's the 2 of us, then there's Warner Brothers, massive crew. So there's a lot of people, you know, it's once you can really trust people, it's really freeing.
Yeah.
I actually think the more apt comparison is someone like Bill Russell when he was a player and a coach. You directed 4 of the 8 episodes.
That's cool.
I blew it. I led with Jackie Moon. I was trying to go with the movie thing. I should have gone with
Jackie Moon's Russell. Good too.
Yeah, I thought it was solid. I thought it was the right way to introduce it.
What? How was that
Celtics
like,
fan? So
yeah, right. But how was it like in the episodes that you didn't direct? Because obviously you mentioned before, like you've worked on a lot of sets. I think anyone that's worked on a set, not where the project is their baby, sometimes has some thoughts and feelings about things that are going down, like things are moving really slow, or like whatever, you know. You're the PA or the audio, you know, the audio engineer. So what was it like being the creator and then being able to direct the show, and then all of a sudden having someone else direct an episode here, an episode there?
Yeah, I like it. So I kind of on Stakeland, we had this idea that, you know, that was a very small budget movie. And we had this idea that we were going to do these webisodes that were basically, there was a bunch of scenes and sort of side stories that we couldn't fit in the show. And so we had this idea, we'll do webisodes. And we basically asked like filmmakers and friends that we really loved and said like, hey, we have this great idea of a story. Do you want to write, you know, like a 10-minute thing and go direct it? And while we're shooting on a day that we're not using that actor, you can go do a whole short film based on this. And it was such a freeing experience, an inspiring experience, because, you know, you see all these different, you know, styles come back and you're like, wow, I never would have thought of that, you know, and it's just such a cool experience. So I fortunately kind of coming from that and then doing Happen Leonard for 3 seasons where, you know, all of a sudden you're working with, you know, television directors and they're sort of interpreting something that you've been working on for a while. You know, I know there are people who get very possessive and sort of freaked out about it. I love it because, you know, you're directing is a really weird and sort of lonely position, you know, and show running too, because everyone on a set is generally working with like other lighting people, you know, other art department, you know, you're working with other people that are sort of in your field. You never really get to see other directors unless you're working, you know, on a shoot for somebody. Same thing with showrunners, you know, you're either working for one or you're not. I started showrunning the first show that I did. So I had to watch a Netflix series called Showrunners just to understand what a showrunner did. And so there's something really I love to just kind of watch like how people prepare and how they break down a scene and what they find is the important thread of something, you know? And oftentimes I'm like, yeah, you were right. You know, my head is way too into it. You were right. So I really enjoy that process. It can definitely be stressful, but most of the time it works out great.
Yeah. The collaboration process is probably awesome. I mean, being able to kind of pick up from other people's techniques and tactics and stuff and
totally
just getting another perspective to help you out.
Totally. The way that I prep, you know, I use this program Notability and I sort of break stuff down and on my iPad. And that was like from a director, Mo Marable, who did Happy Leonard one time. And I was just like watching him and I'm like, how do you do? That's what I always wanted to do. I'm carrying around like a 3-ring binder, you know, and I'm just watching that. So you pick up stuff along the way. Our producing director is named Toa Fraser, and he's done just a ton of shows and really good shows. And like, almost every cool show out there, he's done like an episode or two of, and like, you know, just the way that he breaks stuff down and sort of like, what's great about him is he's very like, no bullshit. Like, he's like, this is what we need. I'm not going to mess around and sort of waste time getting all this stuff. This is actually the heart of it. And there's a discipline to what he does that I just really deeply respect, because I'm much more of like, let's shoot it all. We'll figure it out in the edit, you know, and there's something about that that's really inspiring and admirable. So
yeah, there has to be a healthy mix of trial by fire, but also or trial by combat, and also just watching the combat from the sidelines. You can't just delve into it all the time. I mean, actually sitting there watching people fight. Yeah. I mean, we produce a lot of podcasts, and we produced one that was a scripted show, and they were doing like extra interviews, and they asked us, because we do interview shows, like, hey, do y'all want to do the interview? I'm like, no, y'all got it. You guys do it.
Yeah.
And then we were sitting back watching the interview. I remember like my first time getting in there, I'm like, oh no, like, I hope they, I'm just like getting the cold feet. But then like, I'm watching like, oh, that's interesting. I wouldn't have done that. Or I wouldn't have done this. Well, that's cool. And then you pick up, and all of a sudden I'm taking stuff into my own new work. So that's definitely.
Right. Yeah.
Really putting new things in your toolbox.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. We told you at the top, we have a couple fun questions for you before we get into those last few fun questions. It could be from you playing, watching, anything. What is your favorite sports memory?
My favorite sports memory is I was a sophomore playing basketball outside of Philadelphia. I played basketball my entire life. Very competitively up until like 20. And I was a sophomore. I was bumped up to varsity. It was our first game of the year. My first varsity game. It was like some sort of like a Thanksgiving tournament or something. And our coach said, okay, we're going to play against this team. We're going to play against this guy. He was an All-American next year. We got to shut him down. Mikkel, I know it's your first game. I'm going to ask you to guard him at times during this. Like, you, another guy, Brad Hahn, a couple other guys, you're going to guard this guy. It was Kobe Bryant. So I played my first varsity game. I played against Kobe Bryant. And the first play of the game, I was like on the wing. Like, he wins the jump ball. I was on the wing. And I'm looking at him. I turn to look at the point guard. And I look at the point guard as he's throwing the ball up, passing it towards the net. And I just see somebody catch it and reverse alley-oop dunk it. And I was just like, oh, one of us just got burned. And of course I look back and he's gone.
It's Kobe.
So my first varsity game was against him. And he got kicked out of the game. He was like kind of complaining to the refs, and he ended up at some point, he kicked the ball into the stands and got technical and got kicked out of the game. And then my mom and all of our parents were in the stands, like, you know, yelling, and his dad was on the other side, you know, yelling, and we ended up still losing the game. But after that, we were kind of like, I remember always thinking like, he's good, but he's a little bit of a hot dog, and I don't know if he's going to really be able to, you know, really exceed going forward. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's why we ask these questions. Okay. I mean, we never really know what to expect, and something like that just blows us away. You played against Kobe Bryant. That's ridiculous.
I'm not even blowing smoke up your ass. I think that's definitely, I'm not going to say it's top one. So I have to review the tape. That could be top. We've had some really good ones, but that, wow. That is up there.
Yeah.
And it was really, we had a couple.
Hard, nice cliffhanger, too. I didn't know. I didn't know where you were going with it. I was about to ask you who's the guy.
I hate the Lakers with a passion. But he's, you know, I was really, when he died, I was like, really, it was a real mind fuck, you know, because he was always, you know, whatever he was, a year or two ahead of, you know, it was just always one of those things, like always somebody that you're sort of like, not a peer. I mean, it sounds weird to say a peer, but age-wise a peer. Cause you're like, oh yeah, that's somebody who basically went to like a, you know, a rival high school or something, you know? And so that was always something that you sort of look at. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like, whoa, it's just your whole mortality and everything wrapped up into that was just crazy.
Yeah. He's the only person I've ever, I mean, coming from New York, I was having this conversation with someone the other day, like maybe it was Nick, maybe it was you. I think it was you, Nick, that how big Derek Jeter is. And I never had realized an athlete, like to me, there was never going to be an athlete as big as Jeter. And then I came to LA and I was like, holy smokes, that's the West Coast.
Right.
West Coast.
Jeter. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That is a good one. That's a really good one, actually. And on a lighter note, obviously in Sweet Tooth, there's this thing called hybrids.
Yeah.
So half human, half hybrid. So it's an animal / human. You've been with us for 40 minutes. Right? Josh, Nick, Alex, what would our animals be? I could take my
hat
off.
Me what I'm your asking you for.
I'll take my hat off if it helps.
Oh, wow. I don't know.
Gut check reaction.
Know. We're putting you on the spot here, man. Well, we need to know.
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. That's a hard question. Wow.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to offend us. We're not going to get offended.
Dude, people have said worse to me. Victor Cruz told me I had the worst shoe game of all time. You're good.
Really what I need is I need full frame things because that's really where a lot of it comes from. Cause you kind of got to be like, yeah, that's kind of a turtle or that's kind of this, but to be honest, like shoulders up, I can't really tell.
Please call Josh a turtle. That'd be hilarious.
Yeah. That's where it's going.
All right. So we're going to go Josh being a turtle.
I don't know.
Cool.
That's a hard one.
But after season two, you'll have to tell us.
But exactly.
You'll
have time.
Or you just put us in season two.
I gotta ask, Jim, did you watch the HBO show Mayor of Easttown?
A little bit. Yeah, I didn't finish it, but I watched a little bit. Yeah.
As a guy who grew up in Pennsylvania, I know it's not the same town that you grew up in,
but that's basically the town that I grew up in. It's very much
was it an accurate depiction of
it was at times it was like so on the nose that I had a hard time watching, and it felt a little bit like I know Craig Zobel and I love Craig and but there were times where it felt a little like the Saturday Night Live sketch to me. I don't know if you guys saw that, Murder. It felt a little bit like that. And at times I had a hard time watching it. I made a movie called In the Shadow of the Moon, which is set in Philly, and I had Michael C. Hall do like a really thick, you know, Central Pennsylvania Delco accent. And there was something about that I loved because there was like a sense of humor that he had to the whole thing. And it was like such a downer, that show, that it was hard to not feel that as I watched it. Yeah.
Good to know. Going into it, I'll have that in the back of my mind.
It's hard not to shake that Murder, Dirt.
Oh, yeah. SNL ruined it for a lot of people, I feel like.
Well, I'm drinking some water right now. Yeah, it's always interesting hearing about like people that grew up in a specific place and then they make a show about that city, just like how they feel about the show, if it's an accurate depiction.
Yeah.
And it's just always, on a side note, sports related, but also crossover with Mayor, when Shake Milton had his game where he scored like 11 points in 5 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Someone tweeted like only Mayor could have known that Shake Milton was going to have this game. And I thought it was like the greatest tweet ever.
That's funny.
Last two for you, man. Because we do sports. Obviously, we love movies. What's your favorite sports movie of all time?
I mean, Hoosiers for old time's sake, you know. I mean, grew up, you know, almost watching that, you know, religiously, you know, growing up. That's probably it. I mean, I love, it's not really a movie, but those Last Chance You things are amazing on Netflix, particularly that last basketball one was amazing.
Yeah, we had
not a movie, but
we had Coach Beam on the last football one. Did. Yeah, he was on. What was he on? Was that a year ago, guys?
It was during the pandemic for sure.
During the pandemic, right when it came out, he came on. I mean, that guy's mustache is electric.
Yeah,
I loved
all those. Those are amazing. Trying to think of other good sports movies.
Maybe a doc? Is there a doc you dig?
I mean, I just start to think of all the 30 for 30s, which are mm-hmm. amazing. I mean, Hoop Dreams is amazing back in the day, but really, I mean, in terms of docs, I think those Last Chance U ones are like, they really rise to the top.
They're great.
I mean, I grew up with like Blue Chips, you know, I don't know if you remember that movie with like Nick Nolte as the coach. Oh, I think Shaq was in it, and like Matt Nover, and like, you know, that was like trying to be Hoosiers. Really wasn't. I just think of a lot of ones that don't quite work, sadly, you know, like I remember wanting to love Any Given Sunday when that came out and just feeling like, it didn't quite, you know. It's a hard thing, I feel like, because if you're a sports fan, I feel like you can always feel the move. Like, I feel like it's hard to ever really buy, you know, a lot of times that the actors are really playing. And it's hard.
If you get big name actors to play, you know, professional athletes, it's hard to buy it, like you said, like, you know, Jamie Foxx. And also, if it's a fake team too, it's hard to buy.
Well.
Like if we were to do real teams, like Major League did, I mean, it's a comedy, but like they're the Indians, you know? And like, that's a little bit more, it's more realistic for me.
Yeah.
I'll push back. There's nothing better than Shane Falco leading his team to the playoffs and the replacement. I think though, the perfect marriage for your directing and like what you like to do, or at least what you've done so far with your affinity for sports, especially your story about Kobe Bryant, is the next time someone makes a remake of the Teen Wolf movie, you're going to be all over that. That's perfect. You've got the hybrid and he's a basketball player.
You know, it's coming 5 years, bro. That's you. That's awesome. And then the last one, went on a sweet tooth note. Do you have a favorite memory from set? Like a favorite moment y'all had together?
I mean, there's so many. There was one that was like a weird sort of personal one. In episode 6 is a thing at the end where the horse runs off out of the suburb. They let the horse go and it like runs out of the suburbs, you know, in slow motion and all that. And we woke up really early one morning to shoot that, to try to time it as the sun was coming up. So you get there and it's dark and you're waiting for the sun to rise and you have this horse ready and you have this like aerial camera flying over the suburb, and it's like right as the sun starts to come through the clouds, like go shoot. And I think we got like one or two takes of it, and I remember like driving then to the next set and just like tearing up in the car on it, because you know I was talking to family and friends back home, you know, that are still like sort of like locked down and not knowing what they're gonna do, and it's like here we're in New Zealand shooting, you know, this weird thing of like a horse that's like running free in the suburb, like getting to be let go instead of opening their life up. And like, and I just remember thinking like, at some point this is going to come out.
Ironic.
I don't know if it's 6 months from now or a year from now, as the world is sort of waking up out of this, hopefully. And this will be an oddly symbolic moment, I guess. And that was fun.
There's so many parallels in this show to the outside world. It's wild.
Yeah. That was also a nerve wracking moment. I'm not going to lie to you, because not to spoil the horse does something earlier.
The series.
I thought the horse was in trouble.
The horse is the MVP of that episode.
The horse is major MVP moment. Like I like a Shake Milton moment coming out off the bench, crushing it. And at the end, I'm like, this horse is, I'm like, they're riding this thing off. I'm like, this thing better live. I'm like, Jim, I'm seeing you in a couple of days. Don't do this to me, man.
That's funny.
Sweet Tooth is excellent, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Everyone go check it out. Again, try to kill it all in one shot as much as you can. It's very much worth it. Jim Mickle, the director, the creator, the showrunner. Congratulations, man. Thank you for joining.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Awesome interview. Dude's an absolute homie. Great sense of humor. Again, like legendary sports memory. It's got to be one of the tops. We want to do something special for it. So we're figuring some stuff out on our end for that. It's in the works. But meantime, really amazing. Go check out Sweet Tooth. It's truthfully fantastic show. I cruise through it. So did Nick and Toss. So we recommend it to everybody. And of course, we're brought to you by betonline.ag. Go to betonline.ag today. Put some money on the Suns to take down the Clippers. Put some money on, I think Giannis is a good bet. Middleton's a really good bet to win finals MVP if you want to make some cash. I think the Bucks. I was on Trae Young for plus 700, but after game three, I think it's going to be the Bucks to lose, taking the first one in Atlanta. So Giannis, Middleton to win MVP. There's some good bets right there. And anyway, fans out there, drag both feet in bounds, swing on a full count, rip that puck, hit that putt, hit your PKs because they free, and hit your free throws. Why, guys? Because they are free. We out you. We love you so damn much.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.